happy Monday, everyone. Welcome. This is Pam. I'm your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Hey, if you're listening to me live, would you please click the follow button? Somebody needs to know I'm doing something around here. I won't send you any email. Don't worry about it. Before we get started, I want to let you know you can find us in all social media everywhere. If you want to talk to me, find me on Facebook at 4PamStack. That's the number 4PamStack. Go to my Facebook page at Authors on the Air, too. You can send me a tweet at PamStackHost or to the show at Authors on the Air. I want to just give a quick shout out to our underwriters and sponsors for tonight. My longtime sponsor, author D.D. Corbett, author of The Amaretto, a Florida Keys sailing adventure with a little murder mixed in, can be found on Amazon. I also want to give a shout out and a thanks to Poise Pen Productions, Inc. They are the best promotional gift and author's vibe company and graphics I've ever worked with. And also I want to say thank you to Robert Gregory Brown. Not only is he a very fine thriller and suspense novelist, he is a very talented musician and composer. He created and plays our theme song. So thank you, Rob. Tonight I am with Danny Gardner. I have to tell you, I met Danny at VoucherCon. He's one of the coolest dudes I've ever had a chance to sit down and talk with. We were doing a live show from VoucherCon in the bowels of the hotel, and with Tom Pitts and Les Edgerton and a couple other people. And Danny kind of wandered in and was sitting there real quiet. And at the break, I said to him, "Get closer to the microphone. We want to hear what you have to say." And nothing but profound words poured out of this man's mouth. So let me tell you a little bit about him. He's been a stand-up comic. He's been on HBO's Def Comedy Jam. He's had a career as an actor, a director, a screenwriter. He was a regular push. He was recently a Pushcart Prize nominee for his creative nonfiction. He also has published everywhere in all the really cool magazines, both online and off. He just had his debut novel come out, A Negro and an Ofay. He is just an amazing man. I want to read to you exactly what author Paul Bishop had to say about him. He said, "Some books you immediately know are going to hit your sweet spot. I knew nothing about this gem of a novel, but the title grabbed my attention. Then I caught an interview with Danny Gardner and was more intrigued. Reading an excerpt completely sold me. After consuming the entire superlative novel, it is now on my top 10 reads from 2015. It's my pleasure to introduce my friend and bring him back to Authors on the Air, Danny Gardner. Hello, Danny.
Hi, Pam. So happy
How
to
are
be
you,
here.
I'm just
I'm always
so glad
good.
I know
Me
you
too.
Are. You're the
Me
best.
Too.
Yeah, you're always
yeah.
the
no,
best.
No, no. Well,
and
we
I
all
love
flock
it when
to
we
you,
talk.
We?
And I'm,
yeah.
Now we flock to you, baby, because you're the man right now. You're the BMOC right now.
it's you know what? Normally I resist that sort of talk, but yeah, it's feeling like that a little bit.
It's good.
A girl would be in a big man on campus.
It's good, you know.
Yeah,
I told you you would
yeah.
be. I told you you would be.
Yeah,
are you loving
did.
Life?
You did.
Are you loving life since the book came out?
I you know, man, how do I answer that? I am. But
the reviews
also,
are killed.
The
reviews kill, Danny. They're great.
Yeah, you know what? And the cool thing about it is I haven't been in the scene long enough to make any friends. So
yes,
you know,
you
I'm making friends now. Yeah. I mean, I'm making friends,
yes,
but
have.
Okay, we'll put
You're
it this way. I haven't been
friends.
In the scene. Yeah. I haven't been in the scene long enough where people are writing reviews because they owe me money or something. You know what I mean? Like, these are like people's honest thoughts about my work, which is cool. Now, you know, I mean, if it was stand up, everybody would be telling me great set, even though, you know, we all know I bombed. So, you know, but this time it's just like if somebody takes the time to read your novel, and you can tell when somebody's read the whole thing, like you can
oh,
tell,
yeah.
right?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Just because you know about the fat meat, you know, when you get like you know, everybody
into,
has been given Yeah, yes. Yeah. I mean, you could just tell when somebody made it past the obligatory first three chapters, like when it hooked someone. And so, you know, the reviews have been validating. And
they've been amazing.
You know, at the they've been validating, and also they've been, you know, enlightening. It's sort of I you know, because I'm just doing what I'm doing. I just know how to write. That's all. I don't know anything about publishing. I don't know. You know, I mean, I know what I know, but and I know what I don't know, and I know I don't know the publishing business. So
yeah, but you're getting there, aren't you? Aren't you getting there, my friend?
I'm kind of getting there. I mean, I'm just trying to, you know, when I was younger, man, I would just become an expert. Like, as my defense mechanisms, anything I wanted to be involved in, so it wouldn't hurt my feelings, I'd just become an expert in it. So, you know, I'd become this storehouse of useless facts and figures. So, you know, now I'm trying to resist that. Yeah, I'm trying to resist that this time around. I'm trying to approach being involved in fiction and being involved in long-form writing and publishing. I'm trying to bring as much blissful ignorance to it as possible so I can enjoy being open and free to create. So
I want to share something. You just said, you know, blissfully ignorant. I have to tell you that I've spoken to a lot of authors who've been in the business years and years and years, 30 years and plus and all. And I think most of them will say, yeah, they kind of got it down, but they're still a little bit blissfully ignorant. So, you know, that's not a bad thing necessarily. At least it keeps a sparkle in your eye, and it makes you want to be creative. And that, my friend, is the most important thing, isn't it?
Right. It is. That's all I care about, really. You know,
so
that really is all I care about.
You and I met at BoucherCon. We immediately gravitated to each other.
Gravitated to you because I ain't no rookie. I ain't a sucker. I know who's got the juice. I felt it all over you when I first met you. So it's like,
you're so funny. You are so funny. But you know, I wanted you to sit with me and all, and we got into some really good discussions about writing and crime fiction and noir and neo-noir and everything. And you're really pretty profound, and I want to, you know, I want to say for people who have not seen your photo on my page, they haven't been paying attention or not, but Danny is a black man, by the way. I just thought I'd let you know. And you've talked a lot about being in this genre as a black man and what your experience, how different your experience was. Let's talk about that for a little bit, because I know you and me will talk about things head on. There's no bull crap going on. You're just going to say it like it is, and I like that about you, because I'm going to tell you right back. Tell me, let's talk about that. How's it feel? How did you feel getting into it? I know you told me that it was a very hard thing for you to do. It was difficult for you to enter into this genre and to feel like you fit in with the crowd.
Yeah. And I have to say that because my connections that I've been making with folks have been interpersonal, and it's all just coming from a place of relatability, then I've been very fortunate to, you know, it's all lodestones, you know what I mean? I mean, really, like, I'm building a foundation of mutual respect and commitment to everyone doing their highest work. And so it's not so hard. What is there is the fact that, I'm fond of saying crime touches us all, right? Like, I've said it in interviews. I said it to you. I said it on the radio when we were all together with Les and Joe
and Jack and,
you know,
Tom and Chuck,
I remember I had piggybacked off something that Jack had to say about, you know, what makes a story, you know, crime fiction. You know, the thing about it is a large part of being involved, you know, in the scene, in the crime fiction scene. You know, when we think of crime, we think of crime as having a black face. I mean, Willie Horton wasn't a white guy. You know what I mean? He was a black face. When politicians want to beat that drum, you know, they're doing it to the tune of you know, black crime. Like, you know, when all these guns that are being purchased in rural Indiana are finding their way to Chicago, Illinois, and gangbangers are getting their hands on all these guns that these rural Indianians are buying to protect themselves from the black people that have come across the border from Chicago. So
right.
It's just one of those things where, you know, but for crime to wear in America a black face, incarceration wears a black face, the judicial system wears a black face, you know, the stories about, you know, what, you know, what do you, what is crime fiction look like to a member of a community who lives a life that's mired in crime, or in fact, you know, has to live a life that at many points in history has been deemed something other than lawful. So,
right.
You know, I mean, you know, somebody's crime fiction from, you know, a particular place, you know, a particular cultural space, you know, could be about, you know, an ex-hitman who's disaffected with the whole mob scene and therefore he wants to break away, but he's got to do one last job. We see that from time to time. Well, you know, I mean, shit, man, crime fiction could be my memoir about my family because, you know, there was a bunch of criminals in the family and a bunch of cops. And so, you know, it prompts the question, do we have room for different interpretations of crime fiction based upon an author's proximity to crime? And, you know, I don't know if I work in – I don't know if I work within the genre so much as that, you know, I'm an African-American from the south side of Chicago who, you know, you had cops and criminals at every Thanksgiving dinner. So, you know, it's just one of those things where I'm just writing from my proximity. But I will say this. I will say that more often than not, fellow authors in the crime fiction scene have approached me, you know, up front with thoughts and ideas and questions along those same lines. Nobody's afraid of it. Nobody's, you know, nobody's wondering who let this guy in the room. Nobody's really interested in that. I mean, I'm walking around with a book titled The Negro and an Ofe, and all everybody wants to do is read it. So, you know, I think folks' hearts are in the right place, and I think that I've had nothing but great interactions with folks to, you know, I'm the minority's minority. I'm a member of the outnumbered, and yet I've been made to feel nothing but welcome, and I've been nothing but encouraged by my fellow authors and their approach toward me and getting to understand me and my work. It's just been so great. It's, you know, the reciprocal review, the reciprocal reading list that I have.
Right.
I don't even know how I'm gonna get around to repaying all of this kindness that I'm getting from everybody.
You just entered, you know, you entered the world saying, okay, here I am, and ask me anything and I'll tell you. And the fact of the matter is, author doesn't have a color, it doesn't have a race, it doesn't have a religion. You just are a writer. You are a writer like all these other people. Yes, your perspective is different, but I would imagine a New York author's perspective is different from a California author versus somebody down south. Listen, you want stories, honey, come to Florida. We got crime fiction stories that
are
real and feel like fiction, you know. So,
I'm recognized as being a Chicagoan, you know, and writing, you know, quintessential Chicago stories more so than anything else.
But
I like that.
Chicago stories are so noir. They are so noir no matter what. I don't care what type of character you write. Elliot Caprice is just, he and the iconic city of Chicago go hand in hand. And I don't care, you know, listen, I recognize that you see things differently than I do, but when I read crime fiction, I mean, I don't ever think it's just not like that. I knew too many screw-ups that are not black, I'm sorry. You know, but doesn't mean that your story makes, is any less appealing. I love Elliot. I love that character. First of all, you had me on the throwdown, on the Flash Fiction Throwdown. So everybody who's listening, I've asked Danny to do a little something just for me. Are you ready, Danny?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so we're doing this right
okay.
now. All right.
So, yeah, we have to, because I asked Danny because, listen, I love everybody. I really do. I love Flash Fiction. I think that I am blessed to be able to listen to some of the most creative people ever. But Danny Gardner won hearts and minds when he did his piece of Flash Fiction called The Little Red Wagon. Danny, are you ready?
For you, always.
Thank you, baby. Go for it.
Okay. I composed this expressly for your show. So, listeners, this is all just due to Pam's inspiration. I'm just trying to turn Pam on. So if you enjoy this, it's because this is made to order for Pam.
Thank you.
title of the piece is, it was a Christmas theme. You know, the show was near Christmas time, so it's a Christmas themed piece titled Little
And you
Red
wrote
Wagon.
It that afternoon. You wrote it that afternoon, didn't you?
Yeah, I guess it's all of my stand up and improv experience. I just kinda like ad libbed a little bit on
the
spot.
I love it. Go for it.
Little Red Wagon. The afternoon heat made my little two-bedroom off the Coinga overpass feel more like Labor Day than the holidays. My new client preferred the cold, so I cranked my window unit air conditioner to high and hoped it would be enough. It was the kind of seasonal confusion that made one question everything, like whether or not I should take the meat. Then came a knock at the door, and there she was, all shimmery and bright. I almost bowed. Mrs. Kringle? Nobody calls me that south of the pole. She walked right in. I guess the Queen of Christmas didn't need an invitation. You Devin? Well, who else would I be, honey? I'll take a pole. She undid her black belt, took off her velvet overcoat, and threw it at me. Then she opened her glittered club, pushed out a smoke, and took it into her candy apple lips. Well, or do they teach you manners down here where the sun shines all the time? I whipped out my torch, made it hot, and pointed her to my sofa. I imagine the pixie told you about me. Well, she told me you like bourbon. Did she tell you I like it straight up, like my conversation? I walked in my kitchenette, grabbed a couple of glasses, and poured us both two fingers. When I got back with our drinks, I saw she had pulled up her red velvet skirt to show me a little leg. Her getaway sticks were glorious, frostbit Pilates. Down for the dirt nap? Shit, man, that'll bring down the whole system, and I ain't Hindu. You want a hanky?
Well, it seems they
tease me with feigned kisses.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Danny. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Are we still on?
Yes. I'm sorry. I just had to move my computer.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I'll run back a little bit then.
Okay, go ahead. You're good.
I've seen your letters. Oh, it's frozen. Maybe I was from the wrong side of the tracks, or the wrong code, or the fat bastard had a problem with my father being Jewish. Still, I kept my nose clean and stayed out of trouble. I played the good boy. All they got me was a stocking full of heartache. I wanted that wagon. I needed it. Maybe my life would have been different had I got it. The thoughts swam around in my head like alphabet soup, spelling out schmuck over and over and over again. Everything that puritanical hypocrite denied you, you can have it all, Devin. And you can have me. But the North Pole, it's a fortress. I got an elf on the inside. He can get you there. All you got to do is trigger. And after that, it's just the two of us dashing through the snow. She pulled me to the floor and showed me all her Christmas magic. We did the ho, ho, ho all night long. Screwing Mrs. Kringle just before killing Santa Claus. Oh, man, was I naughty. Naughtiest I had ever been. And I resolved to tell him just before I pulled the trigger. Look him square in his eyes. I tell him. Look him square in his eyes, and I tell him I shagged Mother Christmas. I shagged this old lady. And he really should have brought me that frickin' wagon.
I'm ruining Christmas for people all over.
I swear to God, you come to my house for Christmas. It is the best and funniest piece of flash that I've ever heard. I love it dearly. I really, and the fact is, your acting and your stand-up background serve you well when you're reading, don't they?
I am the funniest author at book readings most of the time. Yes, I will say
that. I bet you are.
Now, how I do in comedy clubs anymore, that's debatable. But at least I'm funny at readings. So that's something.
So let's talk about
to make the rent, but it's something.
Well, let's talk about Def Comedy Jam because you kind of got your chops there, didn't you, Danny?
Well, yeah, man. So it's a crazy story, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, like my entertainment experience goes back to when I was a teenager. I got out of high school. I didn't have any direction. I mean, I think I was smart enough to go to college, but I didn't have the support and I didn't have the grades. So I just kind of, you know, I'd figure something out. Like back then, Chicago was the kind of town where if you didn't know what to do with yourself, you know, if you were a decent person and hard and were willing to work hard, the city could give you something to do. So you know, I figured I'd pick up a job, you know, and,
sure.
You know, you hang around your buddies enough and you make everybody laugh. And, you know, I come from rough circumstances in my childhood. So, you know, laughter is a defense mechanism. So after a while, my infatuation with guys like David Letterman and Brooks and Eddie Murphy and, you know, like I just started doing stand up on a whim, and then the whim just became a hook. And then after that, I was just, you know, for 2 years straight, I'm hitting every mic I can. And, you know, I'm a kid. I'm 17, 18 years old, and I look like I'm about 11. So, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. I really don't. And, you know, I got no material beyond what I think is comically absurd, because all I knew about sex at 17 was if you're not careful, you got to marry your high school girlfriend. Right. So but these other guys. And so, you know, I become friends with a lot of guys, and I had a lot of support from within the company.
Yeah.
You see me plug my friend Raymond Lambert's book.
Yes.
He was he's one of the proprietors of the only like the premier black comedy club in the United States, where it was just like you had to have been doing it for years. You had to have some TV or a movie credit. You had to have a pedigree. You had to be a professional. And one of my mentors was the late, great Bernie Mac, rest in peace. And so, you know, through some jury rigging of some sort, I got in.
Right.
You know, season one was just the black comedians that they knew, because they didn't think the show was going to go very far. It was like hit or miss back then. HBO wasn't the powerhouse we know it to be right now. You know, And so that season was successful. So they came up with a season two, and they had auditions in the New York City area and Los Angeles, but that was it. And then they brought back all of the comedians that they liked on the first season. So then they fleshed it out a little more. I auditioned for season three, and mm-hmm. two seasons of Def Comedy Jam created about 1,000 comedians all of a sudden. So it was I would search. I was going up against thousands of other people. You know, the most Raymond and Bernie's influence on my career at the time could get me was at least a shot for the preliminary audition
right.
to go to the final audition.
Right. Well, it's up to you to go ahead and do it. No.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was it. And I you know what? I was a part of a group of maybe 30 comedians that beat out at least 20,000 folks that wanted to get on that show. And,
I have to tell you that when I used to have a television in the old days when I had a TV, I used to watch Def Comedy Jam, and I would bet you that at some point in time, you know, they say we're 6 degrees of separation. I truly believe I probably saw you, Danny. And, you know, who knew that we were going to meet up one of these things?
I was in a yellow Van Gragh jacket that they gave me just before I went on stage. Here's $100
oh, there you
go. This jacket. Okay, give me the $100.
There you go.
And then,
so,
but I seriously look like I'm somebody's homeless child that security should have got up out of there. I look like
funny.
A child, dude. I really did. And, you know, but then I find myself in a different spot because, you know, I mean, here I am. I'm about 19 years old, and I'm on television, and, you know, It's national TV, and it's a hard, international. Yeah, I get emails from all over the world whenever somebody sees my fresh acne pockmarked face, and but I'm thinking, I could feel that it wasn't going to happen. Like, I could just feel it. Like, I know I accomplished the show, and I know I did it, but man, it's just like, hey, I'm on TV now. When do I get to go on tour with you guys? When can I get gigs on the road now? When do I get a sitcom deal? And they're like, when you go home and finish high school and grow up a little bit, young man, maybe we'll give you something. But right now, so I was just like, I went from being 19 years old and all over
you,
the
place. That was a great trip for you, for life in general, but for what you wanted to do in the future, my God, I need to take a minute here and just say, this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air, Global Radio Network, LLC. I am so happy that my friend Danny Gardner is here with me today. I'm opening up the phone lines at 347-633-9609. If you've not spoken to Danny, call in, give us a shout out. We're going to be talking about A Negro and an Ofe. I want to give a shout out to our friend, the cover designer. Hello to Dyer Wilkes, who's just amazing. He's been a guest on my show, too. I just love the guy. He's so talented and so creative. 347-633-9609. Don't have a copy of the book? Hey, give us a call. I'm going to go ahead and gift you one. Danny, you've done a lot of stuff for your short life. You've been an actor, a stand-up comic, a director, a screenwriter. You wrote nonfiction. And then all of a sudden, you hooked up with Beat to a Pulp, Out of the Gutter, Noir in the Air. You've got A Negro and Ofe up. You've got Flash Fiction. That's some of the best I've ever heard in my life. And just, not to toot my own horn, but I invited Danny to be one of the rotating guests for Noir in the Air. Danny is going to be our host every couple months for Dames in the Dark. On Noir Radio, Noir on the Radio. Because if anybody can bring in the dames who write noir, it's going to be Danny Gardner. How do you that gig, by the way? Are you having fun with it?
I'm having loads of fun with it. Because, I can bring out the worst in women, so it's cool.
You know what I mean?
Like, I
know.
I could just,
but you bring out
I can
the
make
best,
it all...
too.
Yeah, okay. I'm with you on that. We'll see how that goes. We'll see how that goes, Pam.
We'll see how that goes. But, you know, I already told you you're going to be great. Let's talk about the book, Enigra and Enofe.
Okay.
First of all, let's explain the title, because I'm willing to bet you most people don't understand the title. And by the way, folks, if you look at my page, on my profile page on Facebook, you're going to see copies of the book. Well, you're going to see them on Authors on the Air. You're going to see them in the network page. You're going to see Manoir on the radio. The picture, the cover design is by Geyer. It's just absolutely amazing. And it looks like Danny, who's a very good-looking man and has some polished manners that I know his grandma would be very proud of, by the way, just to say. Danny is a very, very classy man. Don't let his little bullshit right now fool you. He's a very classy guy.
Oh, jeez, Pam, you've outed me.
I know. I have, but I gotta own it now. You and I sat next to each other in a variety of different places over there in North Carolina. You were a gentleman completely, and I so enjoyed speaking to you. But now I want to talk to you about the book. Tell me where it came from. Let's get down and dirty on this, Danny. You and I need to talk about this, because I haven't seen you since the book came out.
Right. Well, you know.
So hit me up, baby.
Well, first of all, in the parlance, like, you know, the book is set in the 50s in Chicago.
Right.
And, like, just the 1952, you know, post-war era, you know, and America's a crazy place. I mean, it's looking like it's putting its best foot forward, but, you know, you got a whole lot of damaged people in this country. And change is upon us all. And all of this post-war technology just starts taking over. Everybody owns a TV at this point. Everybody's buying cars at this point. You know, folks are taking the air travel now and leaving the trains behind. And nobody's riding a horse. You know, you got a bunch of guys that, you know, signed up to volunteer in World War II, and they come home and they're still getting hung from trees, you know, with medals and uniforms. And it's just, you know, and then you've got a whole generation – you got a whole generation that doesn't believe you, because, you know, what World War II happened to do was open us up to the rest of the globe. We became interested in what was happening daily in Germany. We became interested in what was happening daily in Paris and in Japan and in Asia. And so all of a sudden, you got a whole generation of people who realize there's more to the world than just, you know, going to college and going to the big city and getting a job and starting a family and moving to the suburbs one day. So you got the Beat Generation, you know, you got, you know, Kerouac and those guys, you know. And so, you know, it's a
Joe
time.
Joe Clifford will love that. Joe Clifford will love you and love hearing you say that.
I do, actually. And it's a time of closet introspection, right? And, you know, folks
and
are really wondering.
Don't you think, Danny? Quiet rebellion. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the title comes from, firstly, you know, the protagonist, Elliot Caprice, of the series. He's a mulatto. He's, you know, his father was black, and his father was African-American, and he died in the race riots in the Meatpacking District in 1919 in Chicago. And his mother was a college student from somewhere on the East Coast that she didn't tell anybody. And at the University of Chicago, met his father during the blues era, you know, the early blues era, and then just kind of left Elliot on his uncle's doorstep because, you know, you know, what was she going to do with a baby at that era, at that time, with no husband, and especially a half black baby where in 32 states it was against the law. So, you know, and so Elliot Caprice is himself black and white, and in the parlance of the day, Negro and then au fait. Now, what's an au fait? Because everybody thinks they know what a Negro is, but what a lot of people don't understand is that the term Negro is actually a legal term. It's not meant to be indicative of a culture. It's not even meant to be indicative of a particular racial trait. It's literally what folks constitutionally figured out. They had to designate a former piece of American property, or at the time property. So, you know, it's a lot less, you know, when you say I'm black or you say I'm African American, you're talking about my heritage, you're talking about my culture. Back in the day when you call somebody Negro, you're basically saying they used to be owned by somebody, but now they're free.
Right.
And so, you know, as happens in any culture of people who are less than educated to the standard of the Queen's English, right? We develop vernacular, and people do it all the time. You know, poor folks got their own language. People in the South got their own language from people like in the boroughs in New York, and you know, and then you don't even want to get into what goes on you know, on the West Coast. Everybody's region, they got their own slang, they have their own semiotics, right? And so, you know, but one of the things that we carry with us from the South is this notion of calling white people of a particular authority an au fait. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you've got a poor black person is not going to look at a poor white person and refer to them as an au fait. See, it's a politically subversive term. An au fait is a white person that can make life hard on you just because they're white and you're not. So,
you know, Judy,
you know,
I have to tell you that I had to go and do, I mean, I knew what the word meant, but I wanted to do a search on it because I felt it was important to find out the roots of that particular word, and along with Negro, which I already knew, and you had explained that to me anyway, but it was interesting to me to go back to figure it out, and exactly what you're saying now, it was revelatory to me to recognize what that word meant.
Yep.
So, I wonder how many people have never heard that term before, because it is not one that is used in the vernacular today.
Right.
Nowadays,
it's well out of use. Except, what's funny is there are some folks who pull me to, and I get this a lot, like, they pull me to the side, whether virtually, like on social media or something, or they just, like when they meet me, when they encounter me, they pull me to the side and go, what are you doing using that term? And then they wink at me. And it's just like, you know, like, I get it, you know, I get it. It's just, you know, and there's a, you know, in the book, there's a page of definition, you know, Negro, mulatto, and au fait. And, you know, the way the author, me, defines au fait is, you know, and I'm paraphrasing myself because I seem to not have a copy of my own frickin' book lying around here, so I'm an idiot. But so I've given them all away, or I've sold them all. So that's, I guess that's what it is. It's just, you know, maybe I can quote myself directly. Hold on a second. I got it right here. Wow, I am smarter than I thought. Okay, so the author's definition at the beginning of the book for au fait is white people of particular economic and social status who commonly oppress Negroes through displays of power, authority, and privilege. While all au faits are white, few whites are au faits. And, you know, no one would identify with that today because we are trying to be an egalitarian society. I don't care what a person says about who's taking their jobs from them, or having to build a wall, or, you know, what needs to be done to get this country back on track. The bottom line is I have yet to meet a person who, if I'm standing right in their face and I'm smiling, they're not going to smile back. We as human beings don't want to segment ourselves. We as human beings do not want to discriminate from one another. That's why whenever we all want to have these limited views, and, you know, and no culture is immune. My culture isn't immune to limited views on other people's cultures and races and religions and sexual orientations. You know, I'm not saying I come from a culture of saints by any means, but on the real side, you know, we cloister ourselves among people with very limited views. If we want to maintain those views, we don't step out into the real world. If we want to hang on to discriminatory views, we stay at home and basically wall ourselves off with, you know, from the rest of the world that wants to think free, with like-minded people who want to be enslaved to their own biases. And that's what we do. But the bottom line is very rarely are you going to encounter somebody that doesn't like you for your race or your gender or your class, and they're going to be able to look you in the eye and tell you that, because we're all just trying to figure out how to get along in the world. So, you know, I wanted to explore culture, race, class,
right,
gender politics, economics from within my work, because, you know, I'm a member of a community that has to deal with race and class and gender,
right,
and economics and politics. And, you know, so but it's funny, right? Because, you know, there are certain reviews that have come out, and, you know, folks have been so bold as to say, it's a novel that deals with race in America, but it's okay. It's really good. Like,
it doesn't deal with race in America. That has nothing to do with race in America.
Right. Exactly.
Hello. What's up?
I think narratively, race is like this frontier of undiscovered literary country, man. Because when it comes down to it, what we can get out of tearing down these walls and establishing commonality through fictional narratives, we have only just begun to scratch the surface of the potential of actually bringing, bring it. Yeah.
But this is why I love the title of the book, because you've now shocked the collective consciousness of readers by that. You've made them stop and say, well, what the hell does that mean? And what's he trying to say? And people are going to dictionary.com and they're trying to figure it out. And that's only a good thing.
Right.
That's only a good thing.
And that's,
besides, it's
really cool.
It's a superlative book. It's a superlative book. And you know, listen, if you wrote a piece of crap, I love you. I'd have you on my show. But I tell you behind the scenes, it's a piece of crap. Go back to the drawing board. You know me well enough to know that. The fact of the matter is, it is a very well-written piece of noir crime fiction.
Well,
Danny,
you know,
everybody on the show who writes noir, neo-noir, crime fiction, or crime fiction of a certain genre, a subgenre, whatever you want to call it, everybody has a different definition. When I'm looking at, your description of this book, I really believe you've got it nailed. Tell me what your description is for noir crime fiction, noir. And then we're going to take a call.
You know, like you hit us. Michael Poole hit us with all of this when he hosted your. When he hosted Noir on the Radio. Noir on the Radio. Michael Poole hit us with this, man. And just hang on for a second, because I got to find it, because I wrote it down to make certain I wouldn't screw it up, because, you know, I wanted to be cheeky and I wanted to be funny, but then I wound up just kind of like, you know, I wound up saying something legit. So, So what I said before was that noir is when white people realize that they have the same problems as black people. But what I meant was, because I was just, you know, and I was being cheeky, and that's why nobody wants to have me on the radio anymore, because I'd just be saying shit.
I always want to have you on the radio.
No, it's just like, you know, noir is when the gods get involved in the best laid plans of man.
You think
you got it all figured out, but the minute you have it all figured out, a plot for the insurance money to off your husband or your wife, or you think you can just like do one last job and get away clean, or
strangers
you
on
know,
a train
you,
or something like that, right?
Yeah,
right, right.
Yeah, that's what. See, yeah,
great
see, the guys,
noir show.
My is that they're indifferent to the desires and struggles of man until man displays hubris And then after that, exactly. God wakes up and decides, well, you know,
no.
Oh, you think you got
we
it all figured out.
You.
Huh?
Exactly. Let's take a call, exactly. Okay? Area code 206. Let's go ahead and see who's calling in to say hello. Hi, you're
hey,
live on
nice.
The air. Who's this? Hey.
Hello?
Hi,
it's Will Maharo again.
I'm so glad you called in. Because you know why, Will? You have the best definition of noir ever.
Ever.
Will.
Yeah, you
ever.
Know, Pam, this is the only way I can get on your show is if I call in.
No, it isn't. You're not a host, okay? I can't do
so
this.
So basically,
anymore.
this is about me. Okay. No,
yes.
Actually, I just want to say, Danny, listening to you talk, now I remember you got shook up when I posted the Amazon review of your Lingo and Ofe.
And you
took it as a call to arms when I said you could be the new H.G. Wells of the 21st century. Excuse me, Ralph Ellison of the 20th century.
And
James Baldwin, because when I listen to you talk, it's not so overt in the book because you're writing a detective story. But you know, back when Rod Serling wrote science fiction, he wasn't that obvious with the issues he was dealing with either. But there's still the subtext. But when you're actually being interviewed about it or about just anything, I mean, you talk like someone who you're taking in the breadth of all these issues, you know, within the confines of, you know, entertainment or pulp fiction. I mean, I'm sure you did, and you did the same as a stand-up, just a little more directly. So, I mean, that's I stand by that review. That's all I call them to say.
Well, you're only affirming it.
What?
Don't go away, Will. I want you to say, because you gave the definitive, really the ultimate definition of noir, simply because you get noir from a film standpoint as well as a book standpoint. And don't you think this is the only time we're talking, damn you, okay? Because that's not true. You and I are going to talk tomorrow. All right.
Oh, not like I'm trying to shame you in public.
You are shaming me. Okay.
Oh,
Danny,
I wouldn't do that.
You're shaming me. Yes, you would.
No,
and I love you anyway.
No.
So let's hear noir. You were the one who gave the ultimate definition. So go for it, babe.
Well, no. Well, one thing, the definition I shared, the short one, sweet one, from Eddie Muller, who's the czar of noir, who's, you know, is the film noir guy, was that noir is when someone knows they're doing something wrong and they do it anyway. I say it about my cats all the time. My cats are very
nice.
All I was pointing out was the term noir, which has been appropriated now in all kinds of ways and is often applied to fiction, although I guess that's roman noir, comes from the term film noir. That's all I was saying back in the 50s when French film critics were designating post-war cinema in America, you know, that kind of downbeat trend and the kind of German expressionist style that kind of like, you know, it wasn't a genre like that was premeditated and defined in advance. Like, hey, I'm going to make a film noir. They were crime films or women's films or melodramas.
Right.
But now they've been around for so long that now it's a catchphrase. It's a marketing phrase. Like I was saying, just like Grindhouse and Pulp, which also have their origins in something that has little to do with the way they're seen now. Doesn't make it any less valid. That's all I was pointing out, was just the history of it.
Stay put. Don't go away. Let's take another call.
I got to pee.
Okay, go pee. Erica,
unless you want to hear that.
You're live. You heard it. Everybody heard it. All 3 million listeners. Erica, 603, you're live. Who's this?
The devil.
Which
you
devil?
You found me.
The devil.
I thought I was hiding, but, you know.
All right, speak up so we can hear you. Who's this?
It's Lucifer.
Hey, Lucy, how are you? Say hi to my friend Danny Gardner. Danny, say hi to my friend Lucy. Lucy Fleury Dunn is one of my closest friends. She's a book reviewer. Lucy, you want Danny's book?
I would love it.
Okay, I'm going to send you Danny's book to review. You'll post it on our book reviews page and shout it out. What's happening? What do you have a question? Let's hear it.
No, I was liking the definitions of the noir.
The definition.
Yeah.
Of
back.
Did you like, by the way, the flash fiction piece about Santa? Wasn't that great?
It was.
All right.
It really was.
Stay still, don't go away. Let's find out who else is calling in. Hello, 518.
Craig T. McNeely wants Andrew Hilbert on the air.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Craig, or is that you?
No, this is Liam.
No, I said Craig wants Andrew Hilbert to call in. So I'm putting that out in the universe.
Okay, so who's at 518? Who's this?
This is Liam Sweeney.
Oh, hi, Liam.
Hey, how you doing,
hey,
Danny?
Hey, Liam, how are you?
Liam, hey. Good. How are you guys?
Good, we're great. Let's hear it from you. Give us some feedback.
Okay, just the thing that was on my mind, especially when I got done reading that book, was where is Elliot going next? I'm only given two choices, but you can of course give as many as you want. But I'm thinking he goes right back to the job the next day.
You want to crawl up his butt and find out where he's going to go? Hello?
Let's
find out where Liam's doing these days. Go soon, Liam, before we go, guys. Come on. This is your 5 seconds to toot your own horn, baby.
Okay. In October, I had a book, Welcome Back Jack, released by Down and Out Books. Been kind of going crazy, you know, doing my own little bit here and trying to get back. I may possibly have another book coming out after that, but I'm gonna be making the rounds with Jack One because I had little medical issues over the past winter. So, but I'm about to be making a comeback with pushing Jack One. So, that's what I'm doing.
All right, so go ahead with your question for Danny.
Okay, Danny, what? Do you think? Have you made any plans for Elliot Caprice coming up? I mean, any further things with him?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of halfway done with book two, and so you know, Liz and I need to find a new home for it, you know, publishing wise, and then when we do, you know, Craig McNeely, the illustrious Craig, got me started, you know, and then things turned the corner,
Craig,
so now it's
Danny?
Just. We do.
We love Craig.
Craig McNeely.
That's
Craig,
my man. That is
Craig. You and I talked today.
My guy.
You know I love you, baby.
Because
right,
it seems like there's so much that can be done with his character. I mean, you've laid him out so well.
Thank you. I'll say this. Like, you know, it isn't giving anything away to let folks know that actions that he took in order to get past the guilt of his early days and get the farm back, it ain't over until it's really over.
That's right.
Hey, Danny,
okay,
can I ask you something?
Good.
Yeah.
Danny,
sure.
Can I ask you something?
Hang on for a second. Well, just hang on, don't, because I don't want to forget this thought, because I actually did open some wine.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought you were done. Sorry.
No. See, so Elliot might have given up.
I'll sit back.
Elliot's given up his, you know, his pint of blood for the family farm, but he has yet to tender that pound of flesh. So it's going to take a minute.
Okay.
It's going to take a minute. Favors that he's called in, things that he's done to try to make right on all of his commitments. You know, some stuff just, you know, I mean, he's a badass, but he's still just one man against a world that has its own agenda. So you'll see. I don't think you'll be disappointed. He stays in just as much trouble over the next couple of books as he did in the first book. So don't worry.
One of the things I really liked about your style was it felt like some of the classic writing in the past, and it really drew you back to there, that if you just picked the book up, didn't know anything about it, you would think somebody wrote it in the 50s. You would think that it would have been something that might have been hidden in the 50s that wouldn't, you know, some kind of a rare book in the 50s. It had that real feel to it. It had a genuine authenticity to it. I thought the same thing.
That's why I mentioned James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison along with Chester Himes, because I think it evokes all those guys.
Will brings that up, right? And the reason why. Like, the reason why, and this is kind of a personal reason, and because you raised this, I can kind of marry the, the both of you guys is thinking about it, right? The reason why Will Vaharo's review was haunting to me, number one, is because Will knows his shit, man. And Will knows.
Yeah, Will,
like,
Will's the expert.
Will's brilliant. And so when Will, like, you know, I'm trying to, you know, I'm hoping somebody's going to say, like, you know, Mosley and Chandler, maybe. But Will Vaharo wants to bring up, I'm trying to get away with it, right? Because, see, I'm trying to fool myself, and no one's helping me with it. I'm trying to fool myself as in thinking that I can just be an artist and that's that. But then, you know, my man Will wants to bring Chester Himes and James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison into it, which, you know, if there was a black literary Mount Rushmore, those guys' face would be chiseled in granite. So, you know, I've got to do
it. Yeah, but you know, there's four guys on Mount Rushmore, Danny. Danny, there's four guys on Mount Rushmore, right?
Well, Danny's including himself.
I'm not good at math.
I know what I was saying. I know what I was saying.
But
you ain't going to call me out, Will. I know what I was saying.
Okay, all right, man. Well, listen. Okay, listen. Can I ask you my question before I forget? Because I'm old.
Go. I'm sorry.
I'm old and it's past my bedtime.
No, that it's the martinis, baby.
Yeah, I didn't say I was going to sleep. I said it was past my bedtime. So back to Walter Mosley. I've met that guy a few times. Super guy.
He's great.
He once signed. I gave him a copy of Love Stories Are Too Violent for me. See how it works my plug-in, and he signed
it.
When I saw him speak, he was talking about how you had to get up like at 5 every morning to write, and he wrote in my book, get up at 3. I mean, he's just like a super guy. I mean, he hadn't read the book yet. But anyway, my question was, though, but you notice you've read some of those books, the E.G. Rollins books. So do you see, you have to give anything away, but do you see – your guy going into the future, like into the 60s and maybe in the 70s, as his exploits continue, like going into different eras? Because he's right on the cusp of kind of this massive sea change in the culture.
Yeah, he is. He is. Let's see. Well, you know, like I said, I'm halfway through with the second book, and tentative title for that is Ace Boone Coon. I'll let you guys discuss that amongst yourselves when it's over. But
the title has to be somewhat offensive.
yeah, just a little bit, right? And
good.
Yeah, so listen, man, if Elliot makes it past 1959, then I'm certain he'll make it through to 1968.
Depending on sales.
But I'm But I'm not like the only thing I can see, you know, the only time period that I could see for Elliot is getting to 1959, because the Kefauver Commission is the thing that is haunting Elliot. It's just got him by the short and curlies, man. And so, you know, he really needs to get through that period in the 50s. You know, the next book in the series, you know, things begin to turn a corner. Race cases cease to become race cases. Now they're civil rights cases. And Brown versus Board of Education, in book two, Brown versus Board of Education has already been decided upon in the Supreme Court. Desegregation of schools is happening elsewhere. And, you know, it starts to get hot for this dude. So, you know, he wants to just take care of his own business. He just wants to live his own life. But because he decides to live his life boldly, he gets pulled into other people's dilemmas. And it turns out
he gets pulled into life,
Danny.
So do you see the series getting increasingly more overtly political as the series progresses?
Okay, so here's my answer to your question.
No,
there's some writers
not political. I bet.
No. Well, no. But I want to be real careful about it, because I know where Will's coming from when he asked the question.
Right.
Seattle.
You know, there are authors who write better worlds than the one we live in, and then they put real characters in them. Mm-hmm. I write the world that we all live in, and I try to put better people in my worlds than we might find in ours. And so Elliot may not get more political, but the times in America because I'm writing a period novel, you know, series, the times in America definitely get more political. And,
right.
You know, it may be a struggle for Elliot to try to stay out of the fray and still survive
right.
and still get through his own trouble. And I don't
right.
really know how anyone who lives as boldly and with as much risk and danger as Elliot Caprice could avoid, you know, the interpersonal level of danger that he has with his own choices, plus the danger of the times, which is a rapidly changing racial landscape in America. So I just don't know. I don't know how he's going to do it.
Hey, I gotta
go,
but can I recommend a movie to everyone? Can I recommend a movie from 1959 to you, Danny?
Well,
you haven't seen it?
Yes. I want to go back to Liam for a second. Liam, are you still there?
Yep.
All right. First of all, Liam, let's give your website where we can find you.
Okay, it's LiamSweeney, LiamSweeney, because I got a weird spelling, .com.
Okay, and are you on Facebook? I know you are because I tagged you today.
Yep, and I'm on everybody's friends list on here right now.
Great.
Yeah, you are.
Liam, let's talk about what you're doing real quick. Let's go ahead and we're giving you a plug, baby. What you doing?
Right now I'm working on trying to shore up a second Welcome Back, Jack. It does have to do with race more, but it is modern, and it's kind of interesting. It is kind of interesting.
Okay.
When I started writing it, there's a city that my city and my story is based off of, and
okay.
What I like to do is I like to take things that are happening in that city and blow them up out of proportion because I love the city,
okay.
I love the architecture, I love the people,
what's
but
the
I kind of.
What's
called New
city?
Roads. It's Troy, New York. Troy, New York. It's right
okay.
up the
okay.
river from Albany.
Mm-hmm.
But,
there
was an incident between the police and a club that was mostly African American. There was it didn't get to the point of riots, but there was marches and stuff like that. And I thought, well, you know, let's put my character Jack in a case that would create racial tensions, but the racial tensions are already there as a result of the city hiring more cops because of the first
okay.
book.
All right,
so the city hires more cops.
Hold on, we're going to take another call. Area code, let's see, 831. Hi, you're live on the air. Who's this?
Hey, this is Dyer Wilk again.
Dyer!
Yes! Hey.
Dyer, the cover designer for Danny's book, my friend who I think is one of the most talented
yes.
book cover designers ever. He designed, well, he was my favorite designer for Knuckleball, Tom Pitt's book. Hi, baby. How
He's
are you?
He's worked on some of my books, too. Yeah.
Hey,
well,
I'm doing okay. Yeah. I mean, I really just wanted to drop in and, you know, just add to the conversation a little bit. I mean, I didn't come to talk about the cover, obviously,
Wait, you said you didn't want to talk about the cover, but here's the thing, okay? You've met Danny. I know Danny. I've met Danny in person. We've hung out for a while. His book cover looks like him, to an extent. Was that intentional, Dyer?
I could say something, but I won't.
Yeah, I mean,
Dyer?
Yeah,
wait,
that, yeah.
Hold on. Because Danny, don't forget, Danny Gardner's an actor. He's a director. He's a screenwriter. He's a player. He's been on TV. He's been on radio. He's been in books. He's done it all. Dyer, was that intentional for you to go ahead and create that jacket?
You know, I'm feeling called out, man. I'm feeling
called
out.
I know I recounted this story a little bit
in December when
I was on the show. Is it Danny in the sense that the photographic model is Danny? Sure. And is it Danny in the sense that his character is probably taken from who he is to some extent? Sure. But it's also Elliot Caprice. I mean, it's
right.
You know, it's about as close as I think, you know, I could get to envisioning the character, because I mean, it's what I have to work with. You know, I mean,
right.
I can't just say, okay, well, you know, here's this cover and I'll just make up this random person. But
I don't know, by the way, Dyer Wilk is one of the best crime fiction cover designers there is today.
Yes.
He created my favorite book cover for 2015, the cover for Knuckleball by Tom Pitts, who's one of my colleagues in the network from Skid Row Chatter. But I love the book. It was also our novella of the year. Dyer's a very talented graphic designer, but he's also an author, too, and he's a music lover. And we had a great conversation with Kurt, didn't we? It was fun.
Yeah.
Hello, Dyer, are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, go. So let's talk about the cover. Talk about the cover for A Nigger in an OFA.
Okay, well, what can I say about it? I mean, I personally, for me, I thought it was a great project to work on. I mean, I think a lot of that actually has to do with the book itself. Now, I haven't actually read the book, but I know that based on talking to Danny, and this is really why I wanted to call in, was I think when it comes to noir, a lot of books tend to be sort of, I don't want to say empty because, I mean, you know, I know a lot of people love writing noir and they do care about it, but I feel like a lot of noir is very kind of almost violent pornography. It's sort of like, you know, you'll have some middle-aged author who, it's kind of like violent tough guy wish fulfillment, and I've never liked that vibe that's come up to a lot of noir novels, and I feel like what Danny is doing and what some other authors are doing is there's a much more reverence brought to the material because it is noir. There is a crime element, but it's also, there's something deeper to it. It's dealing with social issues, and I really, really believe that's a lot more important, and I think there's more substance to the work when somebody can do that successfully, as I think Danny has.
Right.
And I just really appreciate that, and I appreciate being given the chance to work on a book that comes from that place instead of just a book where it's, okay, this guy needs all this money and drugs and kills this person and there are prostitutes and people are getting killed left and right, and there's just...
Right.
To me, you can only work on so many of those before you just kind of shake your head until your head falls off. I mean, it's just...
Right.
I like being able to work on a book that I know came from a serious place, a place where the author really was trying to say something important. So I think in terms of that book and that cover, to me, that's the perfect marriage right there.
It was amazing.
Well, thank you.
I agree.
Thank you. Well, Dyer is, you know, Dyer is a, you know, like when I remember when I contacted Dyer, and like after BoucherCon, after we all first met, and I realized that the, you know, because I wasn't at BoucherCon to do anything but learn and get to know people and get to know what was going on, and so I didn't have a book to sell. I didn't have to. You know, I wasn't up for any awards. I wasn't sitting on any panels. I wasn't hosting any readings or anything. I was just walking around like everybody else, just trying to figure it out. And, you know, man, what I had found was the cover design from the ARC, you know, which was great, you know. I mean, myself, Diana Keeler, who, you know, helps with a lot of the stuff here in L.A., and then Craig McGinley and I, we all, you know, we all came together and just tried to work it all out. But then I saw that, you know, like, it just wasn't going to work in the long term. Yeah, it was cute. Yeah, it was good. Yeah, it was, you know, it was contextually potent for an ARC. But, man, I needed a cover artist, like, not a designer, an artist. And so, you know, so I'm going to, you know, now Andrew Hilbert, who was also published by Craig McNeely's Double Life Press, he had a book out. Yeah. It's a Death Thing. And Dyer did that cover. And so, you know,
great cover.
I just kind of like, okay, well, let me ask Dyer what he's got going on with this one. And, you know, Dyer's been, he was aware of the book. You know, we had done some work with Double Life Press together. And then, so I just asked him to take a stab at it. And, you know, Dyer asked me what I was looking for. And so, you know, I being an artist myself, I know you don't tell another artist what you're looking for, because this isn't like, you know,
it's not a drive through. It's not Burger King. I don't want to have it my way. I want the artists to be fulfilled in what they do, and that'll help folks really, really win. And at that point, I'm helping out, you know, with certain things at Double Life Press a little more. So I got some leeway as far as, you know, just kind of get straight to get the job done. And I said to Dyer, I said, listen, man, do you think you could channel? And this is how we're talking. And we're being really ephemeral about it. We're being really, really open and I mean, almost spiritual about it. And I said to him, I said, do you remember that period during, you know, the paperback's heyday, just after the 40s, where stuff that otherwise would get a black person lynched could make it in print and inspire people? Like those old paperbacks that they would print out of James Baldwin stuff, or those old Chester Himes paperbacks, or just, you know, subversive stuff, man. You know, just like, can you take, you know, like The Fire Next Time? Can you take an Eldridge Cleaver type of thing and put it together? And, you know, it's just this, you know, I'm talking to a white guy from California, you know, and I'm a semi-black man from the south side of Chicago. And yet, man, when he starts turning around these iterations of his paintings, I just kind of, I remember the first time I got the email from him and he asked me what I think, I had to sit down. I just had to sit
down. But Danny,
hang on for a second. I don't want to be misunderstood.
Okay.
I'm saying that somehow Dyer's empathy, it blew me away because he knew what I was trying to do. He knew the way I wanted to see it. I wanted somebody to be able to look at this thing and pick it up and go with it. And
but here's
just,
what I'm
it was soul stirring.
Dyer and
yeah.
I, but what did we speak, Dyer? Two months
it
ago?
Was,
a month ago?
December 4th?
Yeah, two months ago. So we talked about your book, Danny, and we talked about the cover. And I mean, we had a nice one conversation about it. And he just was invested in making sure that was the best damn cover he could ever create. And I appreciated that. Yeah, I really appreciated that because I know some jacket designers, and I know it's so weird to say jacket. A lot of people don't know what I'm talking about, but when I say that, you look at e-books and all that, people don't go into bookstores, but it's a jacket. It's a book jacket. The fact of the matter is, Dyer and I spoke quite a bit about that, about your book and about what it looked like and all. Dyer, am I right? We spoke about that quite a bit, didn't we?
Yeah, we covered a lot of it.
We did. And Dyer was committed to making sure that your book jacket looked great. He really was committed to it. I want to bring Will Vihara back in. Will, you and I have talked often on this show about book covers and jackets and so on. You and I remember the times because we're of that generation. We could go into the Five and Dime. You could spin the rack around and you could look at the pulp books, right?
Well, I'm 53. I mean, comic books. I mean paperbacks.
Well,
I mean,
the paperbacks. Remember, you could go in for 25 cents.
Yeah, physical books. Yeah, no. Yeah, yeah, and bookshops and places. Yeah.
And Will is so interesting because his books and his memories and his thing is that pulp kind of genre, and I love that. That's where I fell in love with noir and pulp. And let's talk about that, Will, as it relates to Danny, because don't you think?
Yeah, I will. Yeah, exactly. And also Dyer, because I don't want to hog too much of the show, but I just want to high five Danny because I mean Danny and Dyer specifically. And Dyer, I know your real name, but I won't reveal it on the show.
So do I.
Thank you.
So do I.
Okay, it's Bruce Wayne, by the way. So I just wanted to say that I'm not going to get into details, but for all the covers he worked on with me, including my Thrillville Press logo, you just give him like a crude idea and he hits you back. It's like he's reading your mind. In fact, Dyer and I have the same birthday, April 2nd.
Okay, really. Congratulations,
yeah,
honey.
True. Yeah, let me say that again. April 2nd is my birthday.
Okay.
You know, so anyway, I do accept donations. So anyway, and Dyer's too.
I suspect Will be in touch with me about 2 days before I'm
yes.
Okay. Created
but,
a band.
But back to what you're saying, I mean, like for the cover of Chumpy Walnut, Dyer came back with this completely retro, you know, period authentic kind of piece. I was mentioning the guy who wrote, you know, Pam, Max Schulman, you know, I Was a Teenage
yes,
Dwarf
yes.
and Dobie Gillis
right.
and those kind of covers.
Right.
And he just comes right back at me with this perfect cover, just like Danny was saying. It's like he, and for such a young guy to have that breadth of knowledge about the history of art and commercial art.
So,
is amazing.
Will, give me your feedback on the way Dyer created Danny's book cover.
I was one of the first to comment on it. Yeah, the first thing I thought of was Chester Hines, and I hadn't read Danny's book yet, but that was the first thing I thought of. It's just the authenticity, not just of the period that he's evoking, but of Danny himself. And I mean, now that I look at it again, it just, I guess, kind of look like Danny. I don't want to be tagged with the "they all look alike" kind of accusation. But now you're right. I mean, I don't want to get into it, but like the cover. Like Scooter Harris's cover for Hard Boiled Heart is based on a photograph of me, but we'll talk about that later. But I see what you're saying. But it's the color palette, you know. It's just the street scene, the kind of like he's in this kind of a position where there's a hint of danger and desperation, like he's almost looking over
yes.
his shoulder, like right behind him.
Yes.
And so there's so much going on there. I mean, on the surface, it's very simple looking, but it's just what makes great art is that every time you look at it, you notice something different.
I appreciate that.
Yeah,
Will,
and,
I love you, baby.
Yeah.
You and I are talking tomorrow. Liam.
Okay. I gotta add one thing before I go because I wanted to say
okay,
it earlier. So
ahead.
I want to recommend a film noir from 1959 for everyone, including you, Danny. It's called, if you haven't seen it, it's called Odds Against Tomorrow with Harry Belafonte and Robert Ryan. It's a classic heist caper noir.
Oh my God.
No. But I'm saying it's from 1959, shot on location in Manhattan, upstate New York. So it's like a time capsule. But they deal with a lot of these issues that Danny touches on in his books, but a little more overtly. But because of the period, a lot of it is kind of subtle. But it's one of the best,
mm-hmm.
I think, top film noirs. So Odds Against Tomorrow, 1959, which is the era of your next book, right? So
all right.
Yeah.
Everyone,
anyway,
I got
to hop off, but it was nice talking to everyone. And I'll
tell everyone. Wait. Tell everyone where they
yes.
can find you on social media.
Thrillville.net. Like, if you say you're like a radio host and you have a show and you want to contact me, it's at Thrillville.net.
That's Will's busting my chops, everybody. Will,
okay.
I'll talk to you tomorrow,
all right.
baby. Thank you.
I love you guys. Bye-bye. Love you guys. The thrill is on. Cheers.
Bye, honey. Thanks, bye.
Man.
Liam, tell us where we can find you.
www.liamsweeney.com.
All right, baby. Thank you.
Thank
Yo,
you.
We'll
yay,
Danny.
Thanks, Liam.
Again,
good talking
right?
to you,
again,
man.
Right. Awesome.
See you later,
Buck,
baby.
Awesome, Buck. See you
bye.
Later.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Dyer Wilk, one of the best cover designers and graphic artists I've ever had the pleasure of knowing. Tell us where we can find you, baby.
You can find me a couple places. There's my website, which is www.aseasonofdusk.com. And then probably
great.
Easier to get a hold of me would be Facebook. I'm on Facebook a lot. That's where most of my clients
Oh, my God. Say your website again, though. Say your website again. It is exquisite. It's a great website.
It's www.aseasonofdusk.com.
Thanks, baby. Talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks,
talk to
Dyer.
You, Dyer.
Bye. Good night.
Bye.
My friend Danny, I'm so proud of you. I'm so glad we're friends. You just rock it. You really do. And I've been sending out texts and messages to everyone. We're giving away A Negro and an Ofe, because it's an important book. I think people need to read this. I think that it's a great story for anyone who loves crime fiction noir. Will you come back?
I will. Of course I will.
You're coming. What are you coming to? You're hosting a show on Noir on the Radio.
Yeah.
Aren't
yeah,
you?
Later on this month. I'll be, yeah.
You're doing Dames in the Dark. Danny, we turned Danny loose on Dames in the Dark for our noir female writers. And, of course, you're going to come back again anyway, aren't you?
I am. I would show up at any time, Pam, honestly.
Tell us where we can find you on social media, my love.
Let's see. Well, you can find me on Facebook, of course, on Twitter at Danny Gardner, but instead of an A in Danny, use a four. Or a numeral four. Yeah. It looks like kind of like an A because somebody else got there before
it's
I
cool.
did. Because that was
it's
a
cool.
Luddite about it. And then let's see. You can find me on Facebook, Danny Gardner LA, and then you can find my author
website.
Page. Just search. Yeah, search for Danny Gardner. And Danny, my website is DannyGardner.me.
DannyGardner.me. I love it.
Yeah.
It's a great website.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm trying to, and
come
I'm trying
back,
to keep it personal, you know.
You are. You're great. I love you. Thank you.
Love you.
Tomorrow
Thanks,
night,
man.
I'm going to be, you stay there. Tomorrow night, I'm going to be talking to Barry Eisler. Oh, boy. Conspiracies, Whistleblowers, and Books. God's Eye is one of the best books I've read this year. You guys know that I read about 400 books a year. Wednesday, who have we got? We've got James Lee Burke on Wednesday, and on Friday, the magnificent Ann Voss Peterson. Come back and join me. Annie Gardner, I love you. Thank you.
Thanks, Pam.
Bye, baby. Thank you so much for spending time with me tonight. I so appreciate it. You guys are amazing. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. I'm Reagan Black. I write action-packed romance, giving readers an escape to live the adventure with characters you'd want to call friends. And with the happy ever after of each story, you can always savor the ultimate affirmation of true love.